a class in books of the Bible that are called Poetical and Wisdom Literature, various titles like that. In fact, we one time had a course in college during the 70s, which they called Praise and Wisdom of Ancient Israel. They covered these books. I guess you could call it that. But last time I was in here, which was right before the feast, oh, I'm sorry, do I have to do something with this? Okay, fine. I don't know if Kate picked up any of that before anyway. It didn't really need to. One more week. But glad we're all back from the feast in one piece. But right before the feast, those who were here, we covered the book of Ecclesiastes, which was appropriate for that time of the year. Did some of you hear the book talked about at all at your various feast sites? Some of you, certain scriptures quoted, sermon after sermon, at all during the feast. Some of you raised your hand. I know the Phoenix Church had these little pins that they were wearing, just to identify themselves, and then they had an Ecclesiastes 12:13 over the pin. Some of you may have seen that if you went to Tucson. So some of you at least heard the book of Ecclesiastes expounded. Well, anyway, we went through the entire book here right before the feast. Well, it is one of five festival scrolls that are read at various times of the year in the Jewish community, and it is a book that is read during the fall festival time, especially what Feast of Tabernacles, Last Great Day. Now, the next book is what I'm going to cover today, then. The next book is the festival scroll, the wisdom literature, or the poetry of the Bible. And this particular book is, in a sense, a sort of P.S. on the feast, a little bit of an additional point to see, for various reasons that I'll come to in a moment. So let's all turn to Ecclesiastes 12, because that's where we left off the other week. I played that Undo His Will, It's All That Matters Now or Ever Will. I won't sing it for you. But I played my tale as you walked out the door towards the feast. And Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13, it says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. He's gone through life and he's been doing everything a person could do physically. He's had plenty of food, plenty of drink, 1,000 wives and concubines. He's had all the wisdom a person could have had. He did everything physically he could do. He saw that it was all emptiness. It was nothing but wind. So he decided that really the only thing that matters is the character that's built in his physical life. Everything else is gone eventually anyway and can't really be enjoyed. It gets dull after a while anyway. But the character you build is what's important. So he says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, the very next book that follows in the inspired order is the next of the festival scrolls, which is the book of Esther. And the book of Esther really reveals this scripture. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, this is ultimately coming in the millennium and in the period of the second resurrection, when people are going to be held accountable for what they have done in this life, according to what they knew, and then we'll have to go on from there, as Mr. Armstrong has been pointing out. But still, occasionally, we do see, and certainly those of us who are in God's church can see God's hand in history even now. Though this is the same world, though man is not able to contact God the way he will later, still God intervenes at times in human history, especially we can see it regarding his own people, his church, certain ones he's chosen particular responsibilities, and if Satan tries to thwart that, then God will intervene. So we do have God's judgment even witnessed to us in this physical life or in history. We do see providence in action, especially as regarding God's relationship with his church. And certain physical rulers, in a sense, even receive certain judgment, even in this age. As you see in the Bible, certain physical rulers who just became so exaggerated in their own opinion of themselves, became virtual gods to themselves and forced people to worship them, were often dealt with very severely, those who had that approach, who tried to sort of put themselves up in God's place. They were dealt with even in this life. Anyway, the book of Esther then goes on, in effect, to illustrate God's providence, especially in dealing with his people, his church. So that is the next book in the Festival Scroll. Now, it normally would not be read so soon after the Feast of Tabernacles. You'd have to wait several months before it would be read. Normally, the book of Esther in the Jewish community is read 1 month before the Passover. So it's read at the very end of the year, if you're counting the year with the first month of the spring, the way God tells the Israelites to do in Exodus 12. that the first month is in the spring. So you count 1, 2, 3, and so on. And the 12th month is at the end of the winter before the beginning of the next spring. So roughly it comes out February or March, on our calendar. So let's say late February, early March, we have 1 month before Passover, which normally comes out in April on the Roman calendar that we use. So 1 month before Passover, this book is read. And it ought to be a book that gives a certain amount of encouragement to people. And I know that in God's church, we tend at that time of the year, right about 1 month before Passover, to sort of be sometimes a little bit down, because we've gone several months without any kind of a holy day. And after several months of that, you know, you're tending to really, you need the spiritual lift that the holy day came in. So about a month before Passover, you need a little bit of a lift. And it's good to read the book of Esther, because it does show you that even though times get tough, God intervenes and turns things around. He'll only let them go so far, and then he'll turn things around. And especially where the church is involved, persecution that sometimes is allowed to come upon the church, as we have witnessed personally, many of us here, but then things entirely turn around and the church comes out stronger in the long run. And of course, that's the way history will eventually work out. Eventually, God's plan will be completely fulfilled and his people will be in positions of rulership, which is really, in a sense, brought out by some of the material in the book of Esther. There are quite a few other lessons in the book, and we'll be going through it in just a moment. Before we go any more into the book of Esther, I wanted to mention something else. There's a way to sort of use it to this particular point. During the Feast of Tabernacles, I'm sure all of you heard about what would happen in the millennium, how the beginning in Jerusalem, the work would expand worldwide, and various nations would be brought in, and maybe keeping the peace would be harmony worldwide, and the truth would be spread worldwide. And maybe this scripture was quoted in the end of the book of Isaiah. Let's go to the book of Isaiah in just a moment. Now, this is going on tape, so I'm sort of sticking my neck out in the way, because this is going to be recorded, so let's see what happens. Hopefully I've whetted your curiosity about what I'm going to talk about. Okay, Isaiah 66. Here we see the wrap-up, so to speak. We're summarizing God's plan and how history is going to work out. And then Isaiah 66, verse 19, God says, "And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations." So after God's people are gathered together, we have the church, of course, which has been protected, and at least, you know, the remnant of it, that it was to be protected. Another remnant was to go through the tribulation. God's church is there in the Holy Land, as it's called, you know, in that area, the biblical land of Israel. And then God's physical nation of Israel is regathered there, and then they become converted, and then various Gentile nations are converted. And then it says, "I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, to Tubal and Javan, to the isles afar off." So there are nations that were not really major factors in the Bible, in the sense that God did not so much directly deal with them. He didn't necessarily send prophets to them. He didn't necessarily have great works in those areas. They just sort of lived their lives. They came in contact with God's work to some extent, but not to the extent he dealt with Israel and certain other Gentile nations. You have much of the Bible which talks about some nations. Egypt is talked about a great deal. Edom is talked about. And Assyria is talked about. Some of these other nations figure in, but not to the same extent. "To the isles afar off that have not heard my name, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles, or among the nations." So God eventually is going to have his work extending all over the world, you know, all the various races and nations, as you know. But we all already know from Matthew 24:14 that still the whole world now is going to receive a witness. So maybe we're not going to have huge congregations in every country, but we're going to have at least some kind of witness, which is going to go worldwide, right? Matthew 24:14 tells us that. If you go back to Genesis, the 10th chapter, you'll find the table of nations there, and various nations are mentioned. Various peoples are mentioned who were ancestors of the nations of the world as we know it. And it's sort of a basic table of nations in Genesis, the 10th chapter. You have other information elsewhere in Genesis. Genesis is a book of origin. It's a book that goes into the very root causes of the way we are in this day and age today, in the end time. The period before the flood is a type of the period we're going through now. And the experiences of the patriarchs are characteristic of the experiences of their descendants later. also the various problems in the world, the Jew air crisis and so on, they're talked about here in the book of Genesis, the origins of it. So Genesis is a book of origins. And you go back there, as Mr. Armstrong does, to get at the root causes of things and the beginnings of things. And here in Genesis 10, we have many of the important people mentioned in terms of the fact that these are people whose identity was carried on in various nations and tribes, families that grew into nations. Here we have the people of Shem and Ham and Japheth, and in talking of the people of Japheth in the second verse of Genesis 10, we do see people. Well, let's go through some of this here in Genesis 10. In verse 4 of Genesis 10, we have Tarshish mentioned. We have Japheth mentioned, and then we have Javan mentioned, Javan, a son of Japheth, and then a grandson of Javan, a son of Javan, a grandson of Japheth mentioned, named Tarshish. Now, evidently, when you talk about Tarshish, there are various nations that seem to go back to Tarshish, because if you go, well, you yourselves have enough of a picture of the world to know that you've got the Middle East, then you've got, you know, if you go west, you're going to the Mediterranean Sea, and if you go further west, you wind up, well, in Spain, in Portugal, and then further on would be the British Isles. If you go in the other direction, you're going to the area of Iraq, Iran, finally over into India and over into China. You go east and you can go west in the Middle East. Well, Tarshish evidently did have some of his family who remained in the Mediterranean region and married among those people who were there. And we find, for example, in Spain, we find the Tarshish. We find Saul came from a city called Tarshish in Asia Minor, in what is today Turkey. We also find, as I mentioned, Spain identified with Tarshish. But also, evidently, a branch of Tarshish can also be found in the Far East. And it was the Spanish and Portuguese who discovered or rediscovered this region around the 1500s, and I'm referring to the islands of. If you look at Bible prophecy, you find a very strong mention of the ships of Tarshish. There's often a mention of Tarshish figuring very prominently as a naval power in the end time, a shipping power, and especially an economic power in the end time, dealing with the beast power going to arise in systems. It's also called Tyre, which is called by various titles depending on what's being emphasized. There's a spiritual side, there's a political side, there's an economic side. So this system that's developing in Europe is also going to be an economic system and going to be based on merchandising and buying and selling and that type of thing. Tarshish mentioned. For example, the 27th chapter, there's one reference there to Tarshish power. Let's go to Ezekiel 27 and verse 12. Tarshish was your merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches with silver, iron, tin, lead, they traded in your fairs. This could refer more to the western branch of Tarshish, people who were in Spain and Portugal and have gone into Latin America. Some of these minerals can be found today in Latin America, silver, iron, tin, and lead. So this could be referring more to those countries, which are becoming part of the European system in many ways already. They're dealing more and more with the common market. They have cultural ties, religious ties, and so on to Europe. We also have, though, in verse 25, the ships of Tarshish did sing of you in your market, and you were replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the sea. Well, here we have the ships of Tarshish mentioned. And you often see expressions throughout the Bible. The ships of Tarshish are often mentioned through the Bible, and often it would appear the context is a in Isaiah 60, there's an interesting reference to the ships of Tarshish, and that's what I'm driving at. As I said, there does seem to be an eastern and a western branch of Tarshish, and Tarshish is identified by most Bible commentaries with Spain, and it would appear that some of the Latin people go back to Tarshish, but it would also appear that very well may be that the islands of Japan can be identified also with Tarshish. And where was I turning? Isaiah 60. Okay, in Isaiah 60, there's an interesting prophecy in the ninth chapter. We're talking about God's people here that he has dealt with, he has punished, and they have become captives. They have been scattered, they become exiled, they become captives. And of course, Christ returns to redeem his people from captivity, as you know. And then in verse 9, it says, "Surely the isle shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring your sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of the Eternal your God, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he has glorified you." So here it would seem, from this scripture, that when the Israelites are brought back from captivity, and they are blessed by God, and wealth begins to accumulate, you know, back in Israel, the ships of Tarshish are used to restore these exiles, to bring them back from far off places where they are. Kind of interesting. As I said, today the Japanese are the major, as far as I understand, the major shipping power in the world. And they have had a relationship with the United States, ups and downs, you know. They've had their war with the United States and now have a very close relationship with the United States. And it is interesting to see that it started out as a, you know, quite a disaster, and as time went on, it began to turn around, and more we saw certain benefits that came out of it. Not that it was necessarily fun to go through, but, you know, you look back on it, you see certain benefits that came out of it. And there's really a lot of humor, even in that situation, looking back on it. Looking back on the situation, there were a lot of really crazy things, bizarre things that are laughable now, you know, when you think about them. Now, in the Psalms, the second chapter, and Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Blackwell in class here has probably brought this out, God says that sometimes he just has to just laugh, because here are these pipsqueaks, these little clods, you know, is what they are. You know, we're made from the dust of the ground. We don't amount to a whole lot. And yet we build up these huge armies. We think we have all this great power. We think we're going to actually thwart God's plan. And it's just to him like a big joke. And he just laughs in derision. You know, who do you think you are? He just laughs. In Psalm 2 and verse 3, they say, "Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision." So he just laughs at them. And there are times, even in the book of Proverbs, when he says that, you know, if you ignore repeated warnings and just deliberately act in a rebellious manner, God says, okay, I'll just laugh at your calamity. You know, if you just want to go that way, if you want to completely ignore me, well, I'll in effect laugh at you, and you make a complete ass of yourself because you're not doing what you know you're supposed to do. And there's really a lot of humor in this book. And sometimes, you know, if you just sort of look at it from that point of view, you can get a little bit more of the fact that God does have a sense of humor, and that God even puts humor even into the Bible. There are some episodes in the New Testament that really are very humorous. They're also sad in a way, but they're also kind of humorous in a way. You know, there's one example where somebody tries to... I'm trying to remember the case in the book of Acts, where there was a person who had some kind of spirit influence, and somebody tried to get that person under control, and instead the person sort of turned on them, and they ran kind of, you know, half naked or whatever. And, you know, some of these types of, you know, episodes that, you know, they have their serious points, but they're also rather humorous when you think about them. But now over here, look at how God delivers his people in this situation. Here you have a drunken orgy. You have a king who doesn't know, you know, who's really soused, and he says, "Bring my wife," and she won't come. So he goes to the extreme of just eliminating that particular wife, you know, in an Ayatollah-like manner. And then what happens is that he has a sort of Miss Universe pageant. He has this beauty contest, and who will be Miss Persian Empire, you know, and she's selected, and God uses that means to deliver his people. It's a very interesting thing, you know, very ironic twist that is the way he does it, through this kind of a means. And there is a certain amount of humor in that, you know. And also, in the sixth chapter, you see how God turns tables on people, and sometimes just laughs at them, people who are so cruel and vile and want to do such evil actions. And God says, you know, we'll have the last laugh, so to speak. And you'll see later on how he turns things around in almost a humorous way. So there is that aspect to things. One way you do see God's sense of humor also is if you look at nature. You know, if you go to a zoo and you look at monkeys and baboons and so on, and you think, well, that's a perfect cartoon, you know, a certain personality type. Like Mr. Wilberton used to do these drawings of certain personality types, like we have in our Spokesman Club manual. You know, you have this person trying to be inspired, you know, you have this inspired speech. There's this person saying, "Inspire me," if you remember what that picture looks like in the Ambassador Club manual. And if you go to a zoo and you see some of these creatures, you really see a humor in it. And you know, a lot of times animals are brought out in the Bible with illustrations of different traits. But anyway, here we have this drunken party going on. And anyway, and also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these various ones. And by the way, one of them, Harbona, you ought to keep his name in mind, because he comes up at the end of the story. So one of these fellows, Harbona, we'll talk about him in a minute, or later on, not a minute. The seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with a crown royal,
to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on, or good of appearance. What does your margin say? You know, good countenance, your margin says. But the Queen Vashti refused to come. And this is, of course, a situation that happened in Iran. There was this extreme reaction against what they thought of was liberalism of the West. And, you know, there was one of the things that they objected to was the role of women kind of getting out of line. And so you notice with the Ayatollah, you had the veil coming back and that type of thing. So evidently, one thing that country has always been sensitive to is where women fit in the scheme of things, you might say. Although the principle is right, of course, as illustrated later on in the chapter, that a woman ought to be subject to her husband. But this is kind of interesting how Iran, that area, seems to have had this problem, you know, of men being very sensitive about their position. Then the king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. And then it mentions some other names. Verse 15, what shall we do unto the Queen Vashti according to the law, because she has not performed the commandment of the king who has the rebus by the chamberlain? Now this obviously is no time to make a decision like that when you're drunk and you've had this wild party and it's not really the time to sort of decide, well, how to best handle the situation. Of course, he went to these conferences. Maybe they were a little more sober than he was. But one of them answered, and the queen has not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king of Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. So quite a sensitivity to that in that part of the world. The king of Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. And they were afraid that this would really destroy, you know, family relationships, because really what goes on in the capital among the leaders does affect others. And that is true in any country, including this country. And what the president and his wife are doing, or what the king and the queen are doing, it gets around, and everybody is looking to them for an example, and somehow influenced by them. And the royal family in countries is very important. In this country, really, the president and his wife and their family more important than a lot of us realize, in terms of the example that they set in various ways, directly and indirectly. It does have an influence on the country. How the head is going affects how the, of course, obviously how the entire body goes. And this was, of course, the silver period. It was not the clod period, you know, the iron clay period. It was the silver period. So at least they were concerned with family relations. Likewise shall the ladies of Persian Media say this day unto all the king's princes which have heard of the deed of the queen. Thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. So maybe I should try to begin to summarize this before we're going to be going on quite late. But the point is that they made a decree according to the laws of the Medes of the Persians. Now this is something very important to those people. They believe that once you made a decree, you didn't change the decree. You know, Daniel 6:5 brings that out without turning there. The laws of the Medes and of the Persians and the Medes, you know, that's a fixed law. You know, like the Pharaoh and the Ten Commandments, you know, so let it be written, so let it be done. This is the way it's going to be. That Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. So it did go out. You know, that decree went out. And not only that, but they also said in verse 22, for he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. So quite a concern that her example would be followed in the wrong way by women around the province. And so they wanted to make sure that there was stability in the empire. And that was an empire which included a vast territory, and it was tied together by a mail system. You see here that they had couriers that were sent to various provinces. They had people that could translate in different languages, and they sent out these messages. So it was tied together by this communication system, this courier system. You see references to that also in writing in different languages in Esther 3 and verse 12, and also chapter 8 and verse 9. They would send out proclamations in different languages throughout the empire. You know, Herodotus, the historian, wrote about the Persian mail system. He said that neither snow nor rain or whatever, you know that famous saying about the mail will go through. That was written about the Persian Empire by Herodotus. Most of us know about it because the New York Post Office has it written, you know, up there, at the main building of the New York Post Office in Manhattan, you know, neither rain nor snow or whatever, you know, will keep the mailman from the appointed rounds, wherever that goes. But that goes back to what Herodotus, I think, wrote about the Persian system.
Anyway, we're in the second chapter. Now, a lot happened between the first and second chapter. For one thing, he sobered up, and then he began to yearn for more expansion of his empire. There was a more democratic society in the West that was perhaps threatening him in some ways, and he moved westward, trying to conquer the Grecian areas, the areas that were culturally Greek areas. And of course, this is where the next empire finally arises, is that part of the world. You know, that is the thighs, you know, and belly of brass. That, you know, that's the next empire that arises, the Greco-Macedonian, it's called, Alexander the Great. This is before that time, when the Greek states are not yet under Alexander, but this is before that time, when the Persians expand outward to try to absorb them. In 480 B.C., you know, there was a decisive battle, but even more so at Salamis, there was a battle that turned the tide against him. And there was even a later battle also in 479 at Plataea. So at this point now, the Greeks have won out. The Western civilization, in that sense, does have a chance to have a major Greek contribution to it. The Persians don't absorb everything. They have to stop at Greece and go back. And so the Greek civilization is preserved, and it becomes later on, you know, the world-ruling empire, and it actually absorbs the Persians. So Thermopylae, and Salamis, and then finally Plataea. Okay, now he comes home. He's had these wars, and he's lost, all right? God did not intend for him to go any further, but he has not lost his old empire. He still has what he already had, those 127 provinces, so he does come home to a major empire. And but nevertheless, he has had some defeats along the way, but now he comes home. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. So he realized that he needed somebody to replace her. Now, I don't know exactly how many wives or you know, he had, but, you know, 1 Kings 11:3, talking about Solomon, he had, was it 700 wives and 300 concubines? So I suppose Ahasuerus, you know, maybe was in that league too, you know, that approach. But he did evidently have a special place that Vashti occupied, perhaps, you know, as the leading one, or the queen, or the special wife that he would work with, and now he had to replace her. Now that he was back ruling again, you know, back in his home base and ruling the empire, he needed a replacement for Vashti. So now we have this, as I mentioned, a sort of Miss Universe pageant. And this is how God decides to deliver his people at this time, using this kind of means. So sometimes unusual means are used to deliver God's people. And sometimes I think it depends upon the spiritual condition of the church, what means God is going to decide to use, as we have seen. In verse 5 is a turning point in the book, because you see the introduction of Mordecai, sort of the hero of the story. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, and he was actually the tribe of Benjamin. So he is called a Jew because the house of Judah nationally did include elements of Benjamin. There were Levites, there were Benjamites, and then also those of the tribe of Judah. And together they are called the house of Judah, and a person can be called a Jew here in the Bible who is of Benjamin. Paul was also of Benjamin. Anyway, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So it goes back to the family of Saul, evidently. So here we have, in a sense, a descendant of Saul, or one of the family of Saul, anyway. Now, as far as who this Mordecai was, let's notice what it says about him further. Well, we could go back to 2 Samuel 16:5. That word Jair, J-A-I-R, could also be spelled G-E-R-A. I think it's spelled G-E-R-A in another place in the Bible. 2 Samuel 16:5.
At the rate I'm going, I don't know when I'm going to get through the book. I guess I'll have to really speed up here later on. But this is the background anyway. We can speed up later after we get the background. 2 Samuel 16:5. And when King David came to Bahurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul. So he was related to Saul, as I mentioned, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. So here you have that same family line, evidently, that we see here. Here we have Jair and Shimei, and over there you have the same name. Nehemiah 7 and verse 7. Nehemiah is right before Esther in the King James Bible. Nehemiah 7 and verse 7. Notice this. Here we have a Mordecai mentioned. Nehemiah 7:7 mentions a Mordecai by name, who came back with Zerubbabel. Now that would make him quite old if he had come back with Zerubbabel. Nehemiah 7:7. There are references in Ezra. You wouldn't have to turn there, but Ezra 2 and verse 2 mentions a Mordecai, and Ezra 3:12 mentions a Mordecai. Ezra 3, no, that's something else, but it is just mentions what those people were doing at that time. But let me just read Ezra 3:12 if you want to turn there. Many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house. Okay, these are